The following program is part of the Inner Circle Podcasting Group. Go to innercirclecomics.com for more high-quality podcasts.
Doom Patrol. Negative Man. Elastigirl. Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Kaldao. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello, and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast for people that love the Doom Patrol and miss the Doom Patrol.
That's what it is. I'm Paul, and you can find me on Twitter at reading_Hicks if you wanted to. And you can email the show at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. And we're on Facebook, and all of our many, many episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and podbean.com. And we are also part of the Inner Circle Comics community, which is a group of podcasts that are entertaining and different, but good.
They sure are, Paul. They sure are.
Record them.
Yes. Hey, look, I think it's like the US summertime over there, so I think some of them may have been on a bit of a break. Not naming names. Suntime Comics. Yes, I'm Mike, and you can find me at AvantGarve on Twitter. You can also find our friendly and lovely sentient show Twitter account, Wilfred, at WFDPod. Paul, what are we going to be looking at on this week's episode?
We're looking at New 52 Doom Patrol. Woo-hoo! Does such a thing exist? It does a bit. So, yes. There is something to talk about here. Mm. So, that's what we're talking about.
Yes. And how was your week in comics and such?
Let's talk movies, Mike. Let's talk comic movies.
Right.
I went to see The Fantastic Four the other night.
Really?
I did.
And how was that, Paul?
It was a bit of a dog's breakfast, Mike.
Oh,
it was a bit of a schmozzle.
Oh, no. That's a polite version of what I've heard from most accounts.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I didn't mind most of the film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think Josh Trank did a good job directing the first three quarters of the film. I don't know who directed the last quarter of the film, but I don't think it was Josh Trank.
Right.
Yeah, because suddenly all the dialogue took a dip and all the logic took a dip and action, and we got Dr. Doom. And what are Dr. Doom's powers? I don't know, whatever they felt like. So it was a real mess.
Wow.
Lame ending. Good start. But if you're a Fantastic Four purist, you will hate this film because there is nothing there for you.
Wow.
Nothing.
Is it true that they've gone for the grim and gritty over the fun and fantastic elements?
Well, it is fairly grim and gritty, but it's not relentless. Like I found the tone was actually quite engaging for most of the film.
Right.
Like I was quite invested in it, and then it basically from the point Dr. Doom shows up, the whole film just takes a plummet into crapville. Yeah, so mess, big stinking pile of mess at the end.
So it's a smiling poo emoji.
Yeah, but it started off better than that. So okay. Anyway, the taste of that was washed away a bit because I watched Justice League: Gods and Monsters, which is the direct-to-video Bruce Timm production, which is sort of a Justice League Elseworlds.
Yes.
And that was lots of fun and well seeded with things to tickle the fancy of a DC fan with new interpretations of characters and alternate versions of things. And yeah, it was very well done and some good action. Yeah, and I didn't predict where it was going. I thought it makes it look like it's doing a few things that it doesn't do, and you get a bit of a surprise, which is cool.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I recommend that, Mike.
Cool.
No Doom Patrol in it. No Doom Patrol, just being clear. You do get some metal men, which is...
Of course. Jeez. We get them, but not the patrol. Of course.
Yeah.
Deary me.
Anyway, but hopefully that one does really well, because I'd like to see more in that vein. Because it doesn't really do much for me, the other ones they're doing, which sort of just redo New 52 stories.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Particularly awesome. The Batman ones.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen many of them recently at all. So,
no. What's your favorite one you've ever seen?
Oh, probably. I'm going to get the name wrong. New Frontier.
New Frontier. Oh, you have seen that one.
I have seen that one. Yes, that one was fantastic. One. I think the last one I saw was the Justice League story that had the Earth 3 villains in it, which again, Tale of Two Earths or something. Yeah,
Crisis on Two Earths.
Good something one. Like that. Yeah, yeah. That was the last one I saw, and haven't really tracked down anymore. So you know.
Yeah. And there was an Suicide Squad one, which was pretty good too.
That's right. I recommend. Yes.
It's fairly recent.
Hmm.
Yeah. Mm. What about you, Mike? What's happening in comic land with you? What are you getting into? What are you thinking about? What are you reading? What are you watching?
Well,
what are you
if I can get a word in. Amiga Men number 3 from last week. That was really cool. That had a really interesting twist in it. Actually got my hands on a copy of Invader Zim number 1, which
you lucky bastard.
Apparently,
I couldn't get one.
Yeah, apparently it's really hard to get over here in Australia. And I did ask my store if I could add the title to my pull list, but they flat out told me no, because it's so hard to arrange ordering it for some reason. So,
they slap you?
They didn't slap me.
No, slap. They didn't do that.
Not quite. No.
Okay, good.
I also tracked down
good
some
store
more.
You got there.
Comics Etc. in Brisbane, best comic store in Brisbane. Free plug there. I hope they give me a discount next time I'm in the door. Also, check down some more comics, some copies of old Detective Comics back issues, because I love Detective Comics and I just want all the Detective Comics. But, you know, I'll never be able to afford Detective Comics 27. it was not a huge week. It was an okay week. The really cool one was also Miss Marvel teaming up with Captain Marvel in the last days of Miss Marvel, which I think is like the second last issue before Secret Wars reboots everything. So
is that a Battle World book?
The story is set just as the world is coming to an end, and Kamala and Carol team up to help the people in Jersey City there. So it's not in Secret World. Secret World, Battle World fully, but it's, sort of just before it all went to crap. So
Secret Battles, good.
Yeah. Secret Battle World 0.1 or
battle
whatever
Wars.
Marvel are doing.
All new.
All new, all different, all battles,
uncanny
all secret.
Secret War Battle Worlds.
Look, all they need to do is bring back the Beyonder and have him romance Dazzler again, and I'll be happy, you know? Of all the crap they brought back from years gone by in Marvel, they haven't done that. I'm a bit disappointed. Anyway. Not that I hold on
Hark,
to
it. Ticking.
Oh, I'm being cut off by the clock, am I?
No, keep going.
No, no, it's fine. It's a freaking doom clock. So, looking at the face of the doom clock, we can see that the last issue of a Doom Patrol book that we had was number 22 of Volume 5, the Keith Given, Matt Clark era. That issue was cover dated July 2011 and went on sale May 4th of 2011. So, Paul, it has been 4 years and 14 weeks since we last had a Doom Patrol book. How's that make you feel?
That is way too long.
It is.
You know, if you're in jail for that long, you'd be seriously be having a bummer now.
The last appearance of the Doom Patrol was their one panel appearance in the 8-page JLU sneak peek, which is available on Comixology and DCComics.com, and that was 11 weeks ago. God, hasn't that time flown?
Yeah, that has gone fast. That's not too long ago, though. I actually, you know, that does warm my heart that it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
That's like about a quarter of the time between issues of Sandman Overture, isn't it?
Oh, don't get me started.
Or like waiting for the last issue of Hawkeye.
Or the second issue of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. at least we've got JLU issue 13 on the horizon, which will have Robot Man as part of the team. So that's something
to
look forward to. Yes. But this week in Doom Patrol history, and this is either just completely randomly slack and lazy or just wonderfully coincidental happenstance. But this week, back in 1988, for the princely sum of US $150, was an issue we discussed on last week's episode, on episode 27, Yes, Doom Patrol Annual Number 1.
Mad-X,
yes. It featured the Patrol facing Mad-X off against the shenanigans of Lex Luthor and the villain with the most obvious codename ever, Mad-X the Destroyer. Why was he called Mad-X, Paul?
Because he had a big axe and he was mad.
Yes, and he destroyed.
He liked to destroy things.
Yes. So if you want to learn more about Mad-X and that issue in particular, go and listen to episode 27 from last week. And it also had a quote-unquote interesting story about Lodestone at a circus. So,
you know. You use the word interesting generously there.
Yes, that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
Okay, time for Doomsplaining, and we're looking at the Doom Patrol and all their varied appearances in the New 52. Ooh. Now, the New 52, for those of you who don't know, I don't know who you are, but just in case, was the reboot of the DC Universe that happened in September 2011, which involved new number ones and new bold story directions and retellings of things, unless you were Green Lantern and Batman.
Yep.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff got started, and some of it didn't stick at all, and some of it was terrible, and a lot of it put the DC Universe in a bit of a bland funk that it's only really starting to come out of now, I'd say.
Yeah, it's definitely gotten better over time.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Books like Dr. Fate, Omega Men, Black Canary, they're all, you know, steps in the right direction, I believe.
Yes.
Cyborg, Midnighter. Yeah, there's you know, DC actually has some fan faves at the moment, whereas, you know, I think 2 years into the New 52, everyone was a bit,
you've got your finger That's on the pulse, Paul.
Telling it like it is, Mike. Yep.
DC can't handle the truth.
Oh, they Paul Hicks can. Reporting. Anyway, so, Mike, you've been researching. You are a researching little devil in your research, and you've put together a bit of a dossier, if you will, about the appearances of Doom Patrol connected things in the New 52.
Yes.
So take it away, Mike.
Okay. So, yes, I, being the obsessive collector of all things Doom Patrol, when there was word coming out that they were appearing in Justice League, I was like, interesting. I wonder if there have been any prior appearances of the Patrol in the lead up to the story arc we'll be talking about tonight, which is called Injustice League, from the Justice League series. And sure enough, there have been some interesting appearances. So let's start with
hints and inklings and sneak peeks.
Yes, some which, well, paid off and some that kind of went nowhere. But
some which surprised me.
I'll bet they did. The first revisit from a loved Doom Patrol character was Danny the Street. Danny actually appeared first in issue 2 of Teen Titans from 2011, part of the New 52.
So let me get this straight. The first Doom Patrol character to appear in the New 52 was Danny the Street.
According to my research, to my records and my own four eyes, yes.
Wow.
Yes. Even more bizarre, Danny had a very small speaking part in this issue. It was the first time Danny had actually spoken. Now, the Teen Titans, for some background, they were part of this whole sort of crossover event called The Culling, which kind of was about superpowered teens and some...
You don't have to get into it. It was terrible.
Okay.
The Teen Titans in the New 52 were terrible.
All right, I'm just, you know, some people might not have read it. And, you know
like everything you love about the Teen Titans, it's not there.
Anyway, Kid Flash had been kidnapped by this group called Nowhere and was, you know, locked away in a cell. And the person in the next cell turned out to be someone called Danny. And he actually spoke to Kid Flash and said, you know, are you still there? Are you all right? And Kid Flash responded. That was all we saw or heard, of Danny initially.
Nowhere were in Morrison's Doom Patrol.
This is correct. But Nowhere in New 52, I don't think the acronym's ever been explained. Or all we know is that they kidnapped teenagers, both normal and superpowered, and kind of got them to fight to the death.
Oh, okay. As you do.
As you do, yes.
It's on the rage.
Yes. Now, see, I think
I can't remember my kids to bring their friends over so we can do that.
Yeah, that's right. I think Hunger Games may have been an influence. I'm not sure what year the Hunger Games books came out, but seeing it was 2011, I think DC may have gone, books about kids fighting kids. Selling pretty well.
It's got its seeds in Battle Royale.
Even
Lord of the Flies a bit.
We then see Danny again in number 3 of Teen Titans from January of 2012. At the end of the issue, Danny appears as his usual street self. He helps Kid Flash and a newly superpowered teen called Solstice. He helps both them escape from Nowhere's Antarctic base. And they reappear in issue 4. The next month, where Danny teleports Kid Flash and Solstice to Red Robin's penthouse apartment, which is, you know, just on the 30th floor of Lex Tower. So, yeah, we see Danny helping them out. He then next had a very brief appearance in Superboy number 7 from May of 2012. He was actually attempting to rescue Superboy from nowhere, but he failed because Superboy just brushed it off as a bizarre hallucination he was having.
That's a good way to look at the entire series.
Yes. Then in Teen Titans number 7 from May of 2012, Red Robin, Tim Drake, confirms Danny's existence, and he's telling Kid Flash that Danny's a metahuman teenager who's been working undercover for Robin.
Danny's a street. It's dumb. Sorry. Yeah,
there's no mention of how Danny and Red Robin met up at all. It's just, this is how it is.
Yeah. You know what makes Danny's a street not better? Explanations of what Danny the Street is.
Yeah. Yep. That's
what you don't need as a Danny the Street fan. Sorry. Yes.
No.
Having a rant.
That's what we do. Danny then alerts the team to Superboy being in trouble, and he teleports all the Titans to Nowhere's base to try and rescue Superboy. And that's when it leads into the crossover event called The Culling, which features the Titans and the Legion Lost, which, Paul, can you shed any light on the Legion Lost? I know it was a spin-off from Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah, Legion of Superheroes characters who went back in time from reasons I've forgotten to do things that I've forgotten about.
Right.
And it was not very good from a Legion of Superheroes point of view.
Right.
And it got cancelled.
Uh-huh. Imagine that. Yes. So yes, during that storyline, Danny the Street was presumed to have been killed. However, he reappeared severely damaged in Teen Titans number 10 from August of 2012. And despite his ability to speak, back in issue 2, he only communicated with them via a note telling the team that he could use the last of his energy to take them home and get them off some bizarre island that was filled with dinosaurs that they had somehow ended up on.
If you have a spare island and fill it with dinosaurs, that's what you do.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Works so well for those Jurassic Park people. So Danny got them home. And they thought he had died, but he actually survived. But he reshaped himself as Danny the Alley. So he's not quite as strong or as powerful as he was. He's not a street. He's now just an alley. So
is this a good moment to interject with the pun that is inherent in Danny the Street's name?
Sure.
You know about this?
I'm not sure where you're going with this, but
okay. There's a entertainer called Danny LaRue.
Yes.
Oh, who is a cross-dresser, and his name translates as Danny the Street.
Yes, right.
Yeah, and that was very clever of Morrison in a weird way to invent that or create that. So, and that's why, was there any hints of transvestism in Danny in the New 52?
Nowhere near as overtly as Morrison depicted.
Wow. So yeah. There was a hint or not?
Not really, no.
Oh, okay.
He was basically, the most they remarked about Danny was that he was a cobblestone street with shops.
Why weren't people up in arms about the straight washing of Danny?
I don't know.
What is wrong with people?
Quick, let's raise
some
outrage.
Come on, there's outrage to be had just sitting there and you all left it there.
Maybe that's an indication. Maybe the lack of outrage is an indication as to how many people weren't reading it, though.
It was Teen Titans.
Yeah. Oh, dear. So, spinning out of the events of The Culling came a new teen book called The Ravagers.
Oh, joy.
Yes. Now, more backstory that I'm sure Paul won't want to hear. The Ravagers were going to be basically the superpowered army of Nowhere. Which is why the kids were being made to fight to the death to see who was, you know, the strongest and the fittest. And then the leader of nowhere, some sort of angel of death looking guy called Harvest, was going to, you know, take over the world or whatever with his army of ravagers.
Now, so, if I was nowhere and I had a super powered army, I would use the acronym SPARMY for that.
SPARMY?
Yeah, this is our SPARMY super powered army.
Right.
That's what I would do. Anyway.
Okay. I think the Ravager sounds a little bit more intimidating, but that's just me. Okay, so a member of the Ravagers.
If this was called the Sparmy, it might still be published today. just my thought.
Right. I can't see it myself, but okay. So a member of the Ravagers was actually Beast Boy. Yes, Garfield Logan appeared on this team, except this time his fur was now red, and this was due to his link to the extra-dimensional power source known as the Red, just like Animal Man accessed.
So yeah, he didn't need to go there with that.
Hey, look, this is what the research is showing me. This is what I know. Don't shoot the messenger. So, in issue 3 of the Ravagers...
Beast Boy changes colour. He was purple when he first appeared.
This is true, yeah.
And then he went green, and now he's red.
Now he's red. I think he's back to green in the current Titans book. I'm pretty sure, judging by the cover artwork I've seen. Anyway,
sweet.
Issue 3 of the Ravagers, from September to 2012. Gar is actually being plagued by nightmares featuring Brother Blood, who's actually, you know, trying to gain access to the red.
Can I just interject? I hate Brother Blood. Brother Blood... You know, worst villain ever. Just so boring.
Yeah.
Really annoying. Obnoxious. Just a speecher, you know, talks
a
all
speecher.
The time. Yeah, a speecher, real good talk.
Right.
You know what I mean. Anyway.
Then in issue 4, the Ravagers, surprise, surprise, they defeat Brother Blood and the team's leader, Caitlin Fairchild, who some fans of Gen 13 might recognize that name, because this is when they kind of took those Wildstorm characters and merge them
unsuccessfully.
There we go. Into the DC universe. So Caitlin is leading the Ravagers because she was working at Nowhere's base at the time. And I'm getting bored even talking about it. So she took them, the team, to California.
Does anyone remember there was a voodoo book at the start of New 52?
Oh, I remember.
And Grifter.
And Grifter.
That?
Yeah.
And that terrible Stormwatch book.
Oh, God. Look. Points to DC for trying something, you know? You've got to give them that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, Fairchild, she's taken the team of Ravagers to California to shelter in the quote-unquote safe house of one of her old colleagues, who turns out to be Niles Calder.
Who?
Niles Calder, the chief.
What does he look like?
He looks like a dude that's growing a beard and wears bikey leathers. And he's not wheelchair bound. He's you know, walking around. So, yeah. Then, in true DC tradition, they decided to do something wacky. And in the next month, November 2012, every issue was a zero issue. So we got to see Beast Boy back when he was first captured and sent to Nowhere, and he's being experimented on in this lab. And he actually mentions both Niles and Rita.
Does he mention a parental connection to Rita?
Well, it's no, not really. He's just kind of like, you know, where's Rita? You know, what's happened to Rita? And, you know, where's Niles? But it's weird that back, you know, in that time period, he apparently knew Niles. And then when they're in the present day of the Ravagers, it's like they don't know each other at all. So
he doesn't say, where's Mom?
No, he doesn't.
Or Mum for the Aussies and the English.
Yeah.
Mum. Where's me Ma?
Where's me Mum?
He doesn't say that.
He doesn't say that. No, he just mentions Rita. So some more connections there, but they're not really well followed up on. So we go back to the present in Ravagers number 5 from December 2012. And Niles has got the kids under his wing. He's allowing them into his underground...
Metaphorical wing, not literal.
Not literal wing. No, he doesn't have wings. So he's taking them around his underground complex / safe house. And he discovers that they've all got kill switches in their bodies, thanks to Nowhere and all their experiments. So that was nice of them. Another thing that stood out to me with that issue is that on the cover, Niles is on a motorbike. But
wow.
It's never mentioned ever again.
And it's not in the issue?
Not in the issue, no. They're all underground in this complex. They don't go outside at all.
That would be a really cool thing if every issue he was on a different mode of transport on the cover for no reason.
And then like finally,
he could be on a hovercraft and on a kite.
Finally, he ends up in his action chair. That'd be awesome.
The action chair. Bring back the action chair.
Oh, yeah. So in issue six, Niles and Caitlin are sort of getting into it because she's saying to him that, you know, they've just got away from, you know, these torturous training and fighting arenas. And, oh, look, Niles, you're putting them into your holographic training ground, which you've called the arena, and getting them to fight.
Because we need holographic training rooms. They're so original.
It was very X-Men Danger Room-ish. Not quite as good. He's even gone ahead with creating uniforms for the kids and giving them a high-tech jet so they can go and rescue other kids from nowhere. So it's like, okay. Yes. In issue seven, we actually see Niles being killed by Rose Wilson, the daughter of Deathstroke. I'm not sure if that's still stuck in the New 52.
It didn't seem to, but based on what I've read since then.
Yeah, very odd. But that actually turned out to be a possible future seen by a kid with precognitive powers that the team went and rescued. Yeah, in reality, he's still arguing with Fairchild as to what they should do to help the Ravagers control their powers. So it's...
Is Niles in this book a bit of a dick?
We've seen him worse than this. He's not bad.
I know we've seen him worse than this, but he's not.
He's not that bad. He seems to be hell bent on forming a team of some sort.
Right, for mysterious purposes.
Yeah, it's never really explained why. So, by issue 10, Niles is then commending Fairchild on bringing the team together and making them a better team, and you know they're all happy, huggy, smiley, feely people by this stage. And then he says to her, I'm leaving you in charge of my complex. I'm going away for a few weeks. So have this underground base and this high-tech jet. And
that happened at the end of the Fantastic Four movie.
Really?
Yeah, they got an underground base for no reason. Anyway, interesting.
Thanks for that.
Spoiler, sorry. Spoiler for a film you never watch.
Yeah. And then all hell breaks loose in issue 11 as Deathstroke...
That's because, you know why?
Why?
Because no one expected it to get to issue 11 and they didn't know what to do at this point.
In all truth, it actually got to issue 12.
Yeah.
So yes, all hell breaks loose as Deathstroke and Rose invade the stronghold. They're going on a killing rampage, taking out all the kids. But thankfully, Niles, before he leaves, has activated his security system. And the security system is Animal Vegetable Mineral Man.
Shut the front door.
I shall not.
Shut the fork up.
That's quite a security system. So, of course, there's, you know, lots of damage going on as AVM is, you know, running havoc throughout the base trying to save everyone.
Bloody hell.
Yes.
Do I need to buy that? It's got AVM in it.
Only if you're a hellbent collector like some of us.
So it's not a good AVM appearance.
It's an appearance.
What does he turn into? Does he do dinosaur, half dinosaur?
He's a good old half dinosaur, half tree, you know.
Diamond, yeah, diamond.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Okay.
In the final issue of The Ravagers, number 12 from July 2013, we learned that the magic stabby blade Deathstroke had been using was actually teleporting everyone back to Nowhere's secret hidden base in the Antarctic, and they were all prisoners there once again, and that's where it ended. That was like,
right where it started.
Right where it started, yeah. So,
a fantastic series. I can't wait to not read that.
It was a series, yes. We then have nothing further Patrol-related until Justice League 24, which was from December of 2013, during the Forever Evil storyline, where we have the evil sentient virus called Grid, which reminds me a little bit of Wilfred. He's actually monitoring his fellow crime syndicate members and their activities, and it's all shown on giant computer screens, which we all love. And one of those screens actually showed the second incarnation of the Patrol. So it showed Arani, Joshua, and Valentina. And Grid saying, you know, this new team calling themselves the Doom Patrol may need to be dealt with. So yeah.
It's a bit of a sexy Iranian, that picture.
Yeah, well, hello, yes.
Hello.
That was actually a really exciting panel for me when I saw that. I was like, oh my God, they're bringing the patrol back properly.
And the uniforms really harken back to those 70s uniforms.
Oh, yes. It's a great
it's
panel.
Not quite as old-fashioned looking, but it's reminiscent.
Yes. It's a good callback to how they used to look. And it got me really excited because I thought that was the team they were going to bring back, because I was at first thinking that maybe somehow in a weird, ridiculous way, the Ravagers might end up becoming the new Doom Patrol. But thankfully that series ended. Then in Justice League 27, from March of 2014, we actually get to see Karma and Scott, poor Scott, in action, but not for very long. Because they take on...
What is Scott's code name? I always forget it. Did he have one?
It's actually mentioned in one of the issues that we're going to be talking about. And Luther says something.
We can get there at the right time, if you like.
We'll get there at the right time. It's a kind of okay-ish code name.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
For those who don't know, Scott is just a white blonde kid.
Yeah.
He's a bit of a dweeb.
There's not much to him. Yeah. So Karma and Scott, they're actually taking on Johnny Quick and Atomica of the Crime Syndicate, and they get horribly defeated.
Atomica is the evil female mini Atom.
Yes, that's right. And yes, she gets herself inside Scott's brain, literally, and kills him that way.
Karma, for those of you who don't know, is the Mohawk young gentleman from the early days of Volume 2.
Yes, with his powers that no one...
We'll devote a bit of time to in a future episode, I think.
Yeah. Basically, no one could touch him, which was weird. Yes. Then after their horrible deaths, we cut to a scene showing a bearded figure sitting in the shadows of a room filled with strange items, who says, "I'm going to have to start over." And there's no way that could be anyone but the Chief. It had to be Niall sitting there. He had like diagrams of Robot Man and, you know, brains in jars, and there was a skeleton of a four-armed gorilla there. So
really, you could disregard everything that happened with Niles before this.
Yes. Unfortunately. That was a really disappointing part. There was like, you know, they had him appear, you know, quite a few times in the Ravagers before this.
Now, these issues were written by Geoff Johns, so... In a way, it's like he turned his attention to the Doom Patrol suddenly.
Yes.
You think?
He was like, what can I reboot and bring back and completely ignore what's gone before? So this takes us to Justice League number 30 from July of 2014, which was chapter one of Injustice League. And this is where we first get the shadowy appearance of the patrol as they're watching a news report where Lex Luthor is basically, you know, being quite confident in the fact that, yes, he helped save the world in the Forever Evil storyline.
So that brings us to issue 32, which is part two of Injustice League, which is a recent collection that's come out, the last Justice League collection that's come out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all written by Geoff Johns and mostly drawn by Doug Monkey, with inker Keith Champagne, and the editor's Brian Cunningham. And where did they come out? They came out sort of middle of 2014,
mm-hmm.
So not too long ago,
yeah.
Three of them. $3.99, there was a billion covers for these, so everyone had multiple covers with lots of variants. Everyone got to do a cover. I did one, you did one, Dr. Ange did one.
We may have done them, I don't think they published them though.
Mine got published, I think.
I did it. Yeah. I got told I kept going outside the lines on mine, so anyway.
Yeah, so this is in the wake of Forever Evil, where Luthor was instrumental in defeating the crime syndicate from the alternate dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And he used that victory to sort of force his way into the Justice League, and with a little bit of blackmail and a little bit of chutzpah and honesty, a little bit of continuity changing, because all the evil that he did before the New 52 has been forgotten.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, perhaps the seeds of Luther's vendetta with the Doom Patrol came in Volume 2 in the early days, so, you know, particularly that annual we looked at. Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe not. All right, Mike, what happens in these?
Well, basically, as you said, Luther's worming his way into the Justice League, and he's saying to them, look, you got taken out by the crime syndicate because you weren't prepared for them, and we know that whatever wiped out their world is actually going to come and, you know, take on our world. So we need to find out what we can and prepare for it. And, oh, look, the only thing that's still not being tracked down and interrogated and investigated is Power Ring's ring. Power Ring is basically the evil Green Lantern, and his ring was left behind and has found a new bearer. So the Justice League are basically trying to track that down. As are the Doom Patrol. Of course, the Justice League want to use it to learn what they can from the ring, but the patrol are basically saying, no, you're basically an abnormal person like the rest of the patrol, so you should come with us and hang out with us. And but in this, Niles is a real, real bastard. There's a scene where he basically says that the ring has, because it feeds off fear and you know, bad emotions, it's basically wormed its way into the brain of Jessica Cruz, the woman who now has the ring. And so he was going to perform open brain surgery on her in the middle of a battlefield where the Justice League and the patrol were fighting.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it was... And he, the way he bosses around the team is just evil Niles. Not a great Niles at all. He's just, you know, he basically says to them, look, I gave you your lives and I'll take them back if you don't do what I say. And what I'm telling you to do is to get that woman and get the ring off her. And so, we can look after her and make her part of our weird, unhappy family. Yeah, it's as much as I loved seeing the patrol back as a team in the New 52 and seeing new incarnations of them, it wasn't the greatest intro, I don't think. It was, they were really at odds with each other. It was more like the team was at odds with Niles, which I guess isn't a new thing, but it was kind of, yeah, really oddly done, I think.
Interesting. It seems that, I mean, we've never really covered it on the show, but Niles is a character that sort of moves up and down the villain scale. So sometimes he's very heroic, sometimes he's like just cold,
yes.
And sometimes he's downright evil.
Yes.
And that seems to have tainted the view of him in these particular issues.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, evil that has been in the character's history is... represented here as him, you know, yeah, as you said, being a real bastard.
Yeah, he's very single-minded and very focused on doing what he wants and having it done. There's a scene in this story where the Justice League turn up and are saving the civilians that live in an apartment block that's being knocked down in the fight, and the patrol are kind of saying, hey, shouldn't we be helping get these people out of this burning building? And Niles is just telling them, nope, go and get that woman. Bring it to me now. You owe your lives to me. So it was, and I guess the other disappointing thing is that there's some great, well, the great thing about this was the chemistry between Lex Luthor and Niles. They clearly had a history between them there, and Luthor knew more about Niles than he was letting on. And, you know, there were some scenes where he was saying, well, you know, Joshua and Arani, as we saw previously in Forever Evil, they didn't actually die. They actually faked their deaths to get away from you, Niles, because they know how evil you are. So there was that, which was great. The downside was that we saw very little else of the rest of the team throughout most of this storyline. It's that they came, they fought the Justice League, they essentially vanished from the page. All we get told is that the League held off the patrol whilst Batman rescued Jessica Cruz from the evil insanity of the Power Ring, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was so happy to see the patrol back on the page, and it kind of, they just faded away again. Mm. So, yeah.
And the thing that underlines this that troubles me is Niles is so obviously villainous that it makes the team that are hanging out with him look like dupes. Like, yeah. They just look dumb that they, they've not cottoned onto the fact that he is not acting in their best interests. And, you know, it's that's the feeling I get.
Yeah. That's what I was saying before, that, yeah, the teams seem at odds because, you know they should be doing the right thing, you know, especially with those people in the damaged building, but they still follow along with what Niles says. So
perhaps there's a hint of mind control there or some sort of...
If you tell me he's got a Mento helmet somewhere, I swear. I swear. But yeah, I think it was as a story that followed on from Forever Evil, it was really cool. It was great seeing a new version of the Patrol. I just wish more had been done with them and done slightly better.
Well, it begs the question, what was the point of it? Is this, you know, just fleshing out the DC Universe to make it a more interesting place because there's different teams that who exist but don't have their own books? Or is this setting up something for a new title or to be explored in a different book at some point? You know, we don't know, do we?
Yeah, I personally, I'm leaning towards the former on that. I think Johns is such a big DC fan, and he has been for so many years, that I think he likes tapping into these sort of little scene or teams and people that we don't see very regularly, like the Metal Men. He did a great issue with them during Forever Evil, you know? Yeah. So he likes to bring stuff like that back. So I don't think... Well, I'm kind of hoping if it does lead to a new book, they kind of semi-reboot them again, like they did with Niles between Ravages and this. So.
Yeah. And yeah. I think unlike his use of the Metal Men, I mean, he did the arc with the Metal Men and sort of left them in a really good place to be used elsewhere.
Mm.
Not that they have been. But yeah. One, you didn't get this impression with the Doom Patrol that they were in a good place to be integrated or used anywhere else.
No.
And, you know, as we've discussed before in the Doom Clock every week, was the last place the Doom Patrol had been seen was in that one panel in Jeff Parker's preview issue of Justice League United.
Yeah. Because, at the end of Injustice League, all we really know is that the Doom Patrol are back at Argus, which is, you know, the mysterious organization that I believe only started with the New 52 being launched.
Yeah, it's the New 52's checkmate.
Yeah. So, as far as we know, the Patrol works with Argus. So, and all we heard was that Wonder Woman was going to question Steve Trevor about them because he works for Argus as well. So... And that was all she wrote, basically. So,
I mean, I am very much looking forward to Jeff Parker's use of Robot Man, but I don't think it will give us any more clues about the Doom Patrol.
Damn it!
Do you?
I think you're right. I don't think I think it'll focus solely on Robot Man being in JLU, and we won't learn anything else. So.
It's a head scratcher.
Unless maybe lots of people buy those issues with Robot Man and, you know, harass DC Comics.
You know, wow.
Probably with a bit of encouragement from a certain podcast in the near future, maybe. Yeah. So overall, what did you think of the Injustice League storyline?
It's a good story. But from a Doom Patrol perspective, it's quite unsatisfying. You get a bit of the team, they're in action, they're not autonomous, they're sort of under Niles' thumb.
Mm-hmm.
He is not a good leader as such, you know, in the ethical sense that we would characterise, and they just disappear.
Yeah, yeah. So, 100% agree, yeah.
Yeah, but overall it's a good story, and, you know, I did enjoy the characterisation of Lex Luthor wanting to be a good guy for the wrong reasons, or... You know, I kind of enjoyed that. But I mean, that's classic Geoff Johns. He's very good with fleshing out the villains and making them really compelling. I mean, he's done it so many times with the Flash villains and Black Adam and characters like that. It's interesting to see, and, you know, he does it well. It wasn't a bad volume. It's certainly you know, the Justice League series, I think the first 12 issues are kind of terrible, and then it gets pretty good around the Throne of Atlantis.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's, you know, it just... And through Trinity War, it was very good, and I loved Forever Evil, and the Justice League tie-in to that was fantastic. So yeah. I think that's the high point, actually, for me, the Forever Evil Justice League issues. So, and I'm interested to see how it goes with the Dark Side War.
Yes. Coming up. Oh, look, so far that's been really good.
So, yeah.
No Doom Patrol in it, but it's still been good.
Yeah. What about you, Mike?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on it?
Exactly the same. I thought it was a good story after what had happened in Forever Evil. Was delighted to see what we did of the patrol. Found the new incarnations kind of interesting. There were a few slight changes. I love seeing Element Woman on the team. I thought she was great. And she was actually the voice of reason in a lot of panels she was in, which was a bit bizarre. But yeah, I just wish this had done a bit better with them and not just have them vanish off screen to be spoken about by other characters as to what happened with them. Yeah, unsatisfying end, as you said. Yeah.
And visually, the team is not really that different to the Morrison era,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
They've kind of got a combo of classic and new clothing and things like that.
Yeah.
Larry's bandages are a bit more all over his face and crisscrossed than normal.
Just a bit. Yeah, I was a bit off-put by the radioactive danger symbols down the sleeves of his jacket. I thought that was a bit over the top, but, you know.
Well, they are a ballad in this case.
I guess, yeah, but it was just, yeah, oh, really?
And that's one of the things they say about Larry is he's far more lethal than in previous versions.
Yeah. One interesting comment that Luther made to Niles when Luther was saying how much he knew was he mentioned the negative twins.
Oh, yes.
And I'm thinking, oh, what? I want more, damn it, Geoff Johns. Ah, dearie me. Anyway, yeah, I thought it was a good story. I just want more, unsurprisingly.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Let's wrap it up there. Well done, Mike. Thanks
well
very
done,
much.
Well done,
Paul. Well, no, well done, Mike.
Good team. Go team.
Go team.
Good go wording. Team. Good work.
Good wording.
Good speeching. Good speeching.
Speeching. Speeching good.
Take us to the mailbag, Paul.
Okay. Oh, this week on the Mailbag of Doom, it is chock full. Now, we are human, Mike, aren't we?
We
you
are.
And I? We are we human. Are. We make mistakes.
Yes.
We.
Wilfred keeps telling us this. You think Wilfred's bad on Twitter? You should see what he says to us behind the scenes. It's horrible. Yeah.
It is horrible. Some of it's justified, though. We got an email, and it sat in the mailbag of Doom a bit longer than we intended, and we didn't really notice it until last week. Oh, we're terrible. It's from a bloke called Scott Arthur, who wrote us an email, and he dropped some knowledge bombs on us that, you know, these are quite interesting. He said, "Hello, folks. I've been enjoying your podcast immensely since it was recommended by Doug at mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com. That's a Doom Patrol blog, for those of you who don't know, and it's a good one. And he recommended us a couple of months ago. It's making me want to revive a text blog I started. Before I do that, though, I wanted to share something I'd prepared for it but never got around to posting it. So this is a blog preview from Scott Arthur.
Ooh.
You recently spotlighted issues 96 and 97 from the original series, which is we did in episode 25? Yes.
Yes.
25. Yeah. So, all right. Pay attention, everyone. This is important. The cover date for 96 was June 1965, and for DC Comics, that meant it actually arrived on newsstands sometime in April. In fact, there are several comics advertised in it with May, June, or June, July cover dates as now on sale. But a full page ad for the 80 page giant number 11 on sale everywhere April 15th. The implication is that ads with specific dates are for comics that are not now on sale, but on sale the same week as the one you're holding or later. With me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Good. The second piece to this is that on page 3, there is a man accepting a statue symbolizing peace. So this was the issue where people were going mind controlled and the robot, giant musical robot
jukebox,
which has taken on a life of its own on Twitter, hasn't it?
Haven't it just?
Anyway, the first guy to go nuts was the man Balu Sutra could easily be mistaken for the generic Indian politician. But he looks remarkably like the Indian Prime Minister at the time, Lal Bahadur Shastri. He even had the same initials. The story involves Sutra becoming one of the several prominent people being driven insane by a monkey idol and becoming violent. Shastri was a devoted follower of Gandhi, this is in real life, and succeeded Nehru as Prime Minister. Note the Nehru collar on page 3, panel 2. Yeah, so that Indian bloke in the comic had a Nehru collar, which is the sort of collar without any flip-over bits.
Okay.
Technically, that's the explanation, I believe.
Okay.
Anyway, however, on April 8th, 1965... So this is exactly around the time this comic was published. Mm-hmm. After months of observing one another, the Pakistani and Indian military began attacking each other at several locations, suddenly and without a formal declaration of war, beginning with each other's border police and then escalating. Fighting continued until January 1966, when Shastri and his Pakistani counterpart met in a third neutral country to sign a peace treaty, after which Shastri dropped dead before he could even return home. Wow. So the comic is imitating life, or the life is imitating the comic, because the comic came out and had about a peaceful man who suddenly goes violent. And in real life, India and Pakistan got violent with each other suddenly without warning.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Anyway, and Scott goes on. The timing of his death has understandably generated some of the world's most persistent conspiracy theories and would be right up the Doom Patrol's alley. Mysterious death. Mm. Even weirder, how could Drake and Premiani possibly know that a man so devoted to peace would so suddenly be caught up in violence? Although, admittedly, it was unlikely that he sanctioned it, since they would have had to have written the story and drawn the story months before it arrived on the stands.
Mm.
Wow.
That's, yeah.
Isn't that crazy? And he goes on to put in his answer to the question of the week for the next week, which I will honour by reading now. We talked about what was your blind spot in comics, a bit you wanted to fill in. And he said, as for the blind spot question, that's a good one for me because the emphasis on my collecting for the last decade has been filling in holes in my collection and rereading runs in order that I had previously read piecemeal and incompletely. In most of those cases, I've read more than half of them at earlier dates, as much as 90%. I'm just gaining a new context. Best example, I've completed runs, 20% reprint, 80% original for both Cerebus, 1 to 300, and Avengers, 1 to 402.
Wow.
Wow. And hoping I live long enough to read them both.
But that's, both of those series, that's quite a commitment right there.
Yeah, I've not read all of those.
No.
I've never read any Cerebus, actually.
And I've got the first phone book collection.
Okay. So, interesting. Yes. And he also goes on, more relevant, I've placed an order for soon-to-be-published Omnibus for Puma Blues, based on having read only 3 issues. I always meant to find the rest, but never tracked them down, so that would be mine. Huh. Thanks, Scott. Thank you, Scott, for your email.
Thanks, Scott.
We missed it earlier.
Yeah. I'd blame Wilfred if we could, but we can't.
Yeah. We have to blame ourselves.
Yep.
Anyway, that brings us to last week's question of the week, which was, what was a mystery in comics that you enjoyed speculating about? And we heard from Joseph, who's at Rusted Mecca, and he said, Watchmen, really enjoyed guessing who was targeting Minutemen, Rorschach and the team. Also, Batman Inc., and he, spoilers here, loved the Talia al Ghul surprise. She was the villain of that book.
Ooh, okay. Ooh. Don't need to read that now. I'll hop on.
Dies.
What?
But he gets better.
What? I'll tack on to Joseph's answer there. Yeah, Watchmen was my answer too. Just figuring out what was going on there. That was a great mystery that I loved. We also heard from Karthik Kakarala, who said he enjoyed trying to figure out Thor's identity, not Odinson, which he smugly ended up being right about.
Is that the cheeky Thor? The cheeky Thor?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. He also answered with when the next WFD episode would come out.
Oh,
I think he missed us.
Having a shot at us, isn't he?
Well, yeah. We're hard. You know, he must have missed us. You know, he's a dedicated fan.
Okay. We heard from Nick Wetmore, who's at Nick Wetmore on Twitter. And he said, getting the Elektra reveal in New Avengers 31. I was ravenous to hear people's theories about it. That was, if I remember correctly, Elektra was actually a Skrull. Wasn't that the case?
I'm not sure. I have not read that one.
I think it was right before the Secret Invasion.
Okay.
And all the little hints were there. So
oh, very, right, yes. I think that may have been it, yeah. Okay. Moby One wrote in at Shmobu1 on Twitter, and he said, one I remember really enjoying was, who was the mystery pie thrower in Suicide Squad?
That's a good one.
Okay.
It's a really good mystery.
All right.
It's fun, but it goes for about 25 issues. So
wow. It's a lot of pies.
Yeah. We heard from Arbud, who's Arbud F09, and he said, would not say enjoying it, but he's curious about who's the writer X in The Brotherhood, an X-Men spin-off with terrorist mutants. Not read that, don't know who.
No, same here. We heard from Rifty, good old Rifty, at Rift1821. He said, thanks to @reading_Hicks, sounds like a nice bloke, who killed Sue Dibney in Identity Crisis? Luckily, it was trade, and I didn't have to wait for the issues. #torture.
Nice.
Mm.
Mm. We heard from Keith Bowden, who's at Blue Perfect Nemo. And he said, who is Carrion? I sent in an incorrect answer with a friend, so the response was split in two and sent to us on separate cards.
Huh.
Interesting. I don't know about Carrion. Is that a Marvel character?
I'm not sure.
Hmm.
Oh, I'll have to do some more research into that.
Yeah.
At Ostrakus1, live at New Chime Trek, he said, Wolverine's origin until Marvel ruined things by revealing it.
All right, go Marvel.
Yes.
They did that in the papers, didn't they?
I don't know.
Papers, I sound so 1970s.
Yeah.
Keith Bowden added a runner-up, and he said the elf with the gun from Defenders. I don't know that either.
Oh, wow. Keith is throwing some mysteries at us now.
Oh, yeah.
We'll have to go and figure out. Thanks, Keith. We also heard from Dr. Ange. He is the man. Hi, Ange. He sent in an email about the mysteries, and he says, there are plenty of mysteries that I am sure you're going to hear about. Who was the mask killer in Watchmen? Who was Monarch in Armageddon 2001? Who was a killer in Identity Crisis? Or even, who was the Hobgoblin? For me, two stand out, and for different reasons. Who is Sensor Girl in the Legion was a long-form mystery, with hints being dropped for about a year before the mask came off. Ange was / am... he says, a huge Legion fan, so I was on board and invested. It didn't hurt that it came on the heels of the Crisis, and there were plenty of reasons that Sensor Girl could have been Supergirl. In the end, I was pretty upset with the reveal that she was Projectra, mostly because the powers Sensor Girl showed were way more powerful than Jackie's. But when you look beyond the powers, all the clues were there. The second mystery was, who killed Mr. Terrific? From JLA 171 to 172, Ange says, I was really a little kid. I didn't know who Mr. Terrific was, but this was the time when heroes dying meant something. Don't you miss those days, Paul?
Do.
They didn't all bloody come back all the time. Yeah. Ange continues, I thought this was a huge deal, and this was the first time I saw Huntress or Power Girl. So when it turns out to be a possessed Flash of Earth 2, I was blown away. There is a ton of nostalgia in my ranking this. This era's JLA and Dick Dillon's art were a gateway to the big DC universe. Cool.
I have never read that story, but I have read a follow-up story about that story, which was about the JSA having their revenge on the person who possessed the Flash, and it was a dude called the Spirit King.
Huh.
And Geoff Johns did that in his run of JSA.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ange.
Thanks, Ange. Love your emails, mate. Keep them coming anytime. And lastly, we heard from Martin Gray, who we missed the week before because we're crap. And he said, best comic book mystery, who is Sensor Girl in the Paul Levitz, Greg LaRocque Legion? Which is the same as what Ange said.
Yeah.
So it was a good one. And also a quick thanks to Martin, because he wrote an article for panels.net about really good podcasts and included us for some reason. So,
thanks, Martin.
Yeah, we dig you, Martin. Thank you. I guess I've got to give my answer now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You ready? James Robinson with artist Paul Smith did a series called The Golden Age.
Yes.
Yes? You ever read this?
No.
Okay, cool. And it was this dweeby guy goes to get superpowers. It reminds you a bit of Captain America. It's because it's set in the 50s, this series.
Right.
And he gets superpowers and then starts acting completely different with his superpowers. And the big mystery is, why is he acting so different? And the reveal, which I won't reveal here, is incredibly cool as to why he was acting so differently.
Oh.
Super cool.
Wow.
I love that series. It's so good.
I think that's the most excited I've heard you all episode.
It's better than talking about the Ravagers.
Fair call. I haven't even read The Golden Age yet.
So those of you who have read that will know what I'm talking about. Right. So if you've read that, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Mm.
Well.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that brings us to the end of this here thing that we're doing. And if you wanted to get in contact with us or, you know, just drop us nice emails like we got from Scott and from Ange, you can email us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. If you want to send us a tweet, you can go to @WFDpod or our individual Twitter names. And we also have the Waiting for Doom Facebook page, which we barely ever look at.
Well, you don't. But I'm on there all the time, dude.
Anyway, so next week on the show, we're going back to Volume 2 of the Doom Patrol, the Kupperberg issues, the early stuff, and we're going to do issues 4 to 6. Mm-hmm. And just a quick note, one of the amusing things about issue 5 of that series is it had a letter from Geoff Johns in it as a fan before he was a comic professional of note.
That's cool.
So he is actually a legitimate fan from way back.
Yeah. Awesome.
And we do have a question of the week for next week.
What's the question of the week for next week, Paul?
The question of the week for next week, Mike, is what's the weirdest thing you've read in a comic?
Wow, that's...
That's a question of the week, isn't it?
That's quite a question.
Yeah. Sweet.
Yes. Cool. Okay, well, that's our show for this week. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And yeah, we'll catch you guys again next time. See ya.
Bye.